Oh, no. That's like party time. All righty. Okay, welcome. This is, we're going to finish up now the spinal cord class. I know we have just a little bit more to do on that, and then we'll get into the peripheral nervous system. So if you can all turn to the spinal cord portion of your handouts, very, very end of it, go to the last track we did. And what was that track called? Okay, I'm here cortical spinal, but I want to hear more.
Lateral.
Lateral cortical spinal. Great. Lateral tells you where it runs within the spinal cord. It runs in the lateral column. Is the lateral column white or gray matter?
White.
White, good. All columns are gray are white matter. What do we call gray matter in the spinal cord? Yeah, but what do we call them? Horns. Horns. Okay, so if I say columns, you know it's white matter. If I say horns, gray matter. Great. So lateral cortical spinal tract, we're talking it runs lateral as far as white matter goes. Cortical spinal tells you the direction of the impulse. Cortical, we're referring to the cerebral cortex to the spine. So you know it's a motor tract, right? It's going down. Going down, leaving the central nervous system, going peripheral, motor tract. How many neurons are involved here?
Two.
Two neurons, great. And what do we call those two neurons in general? Great. Upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron. The upper motor neuron has its cell body in the cerebral cortex. Axon comes down out of the cerebrum via the internal capsule. That's the in and out way of the cerebrum. Goes past the midbrain, past the pons. What happens in the medulla? Okay, I'm hearing it crosses. Does everyone agree with that? Does anyone want to take the answer at synapses? Don't. Don't take the answer at synapses. It only crosses. So same axon crosses and continues down. We're talking one neuron here, upper motor neuron. It gets down to the level of the spinal cord where it's going to exit. And at that level, it's synapses. Where does the synapse happen? Within what structure? Okay, ventral horn. It's happening onto the cell body dendrites of the lower motor neuron. The cell body dendrites are part of the gray matter, so we're in the ventral horn here. Synapse occurs, neurotransmitter goes across, the impulse continues on in the lower motor neuron, which means there was enough stimulus to cause depolarization of that neuron. Lower motor neuron, so the cell body is located in the ventral horn. Which route does it take to get out of the spinal cord or get to the spinal nerve? Ventral route. The ventral horn is motor, the ventral route is motor. Great, so it's going out, the axon is leaving via the ventral root, goes into the spinal nerve, and then continues on to get to whatever muscle or gland it's going to innervate. Great, so that's the track. I'm really impressed with you guys. Did some work last night, huh? Good, good, good. Okay, so clinically, what happens when you have an injury on this track? Well, it depends where the injury is. If it's up in the brain, where are you going to see the weakness? Or the contralateral, because that tract crosses in the medulla. So everything above the medulla, which is almost everything brain, medulla is the most inferior part of the brain. So everything brain, injury-wise, the results will be seen contralateral. If it occurs in the spinal cord, where are you going to see the same side, because it's already crossed. And if it occurs out in the extremity, same side. That's the no-brainer one. Okay, good. But there's more to talking about clinical disorders than just this. Where the lesion is, where you're going to see the problems. When you have an upper motor neuron injury, so anywhere from the brain down to the spinal cord, you're going to the patient will present different than if they have a lower motor neuron injury. And it's all about reflexes. Reflexes. You don't have the reflex class yet, so this is kind of your little commercial for it. For a reflex to occur, You need sensation to come in. Goes to the spinal cord. Remember that interneuron? I sure hope so. Interneuron's the little bridge in the spinal cord. You have them elsewhere, but in the spinal cord, they're bridges. They bridge that sensory information coming in to a motor efferent neuron going out and produce a response, a reflex. Does it take the brain to make a reflex? No. And some reflexes involve the brain, but not your common, everyday, simple reflex loop. It doesn't take the brain. So if you have an upper motor neuron problem, and only upper motor neuron, brain injury, can that reflex still work? Yeah. So your patients that have brain injuries are going to still have reflexes. Even though they can't control that muscle voluntarily, they can still have a reflex to make that muscle work. And in fact, your brain dampens your reflexes. Trust me on this one. We'll talk more in the class about it, but it dampens your reflexes. So if you have an upper motor neuron, the weak reflex actually goes wild. Wild reflex. You ever see someone with a stroke and they hold their arm like this? Okay? That's because the reflex that puts tone into their arm, and we kind of talked a little bit about tone, that's your postural thing, it keeps your muscles from being totally limp, actually increases the tone to the point where they get into these weird positions. All right? You take someone with a spinal cord injury and you touch the ball of their foot, and their foot will kind of spasm out and jerk out into an extension pattern. All right? And that's, they have no control of their leg muscles voluntarily. They have a spinal cord injury. But I can make the reflexes work in their legs. So that's the difference between injuring the upper motor neuron and the lower. You injure the upper motor neuron, reflexes will still be there, and you'll see some weird things because reflexes go wild. If you injure the lower motor neuron, are you going to have a reflex? No. Are you going to be able to control the muscle voluntarily? No. So you have nothing. That's the difference clinically between these two neurons, and that's why, part of the reason why it's important to understand the track. All right. Any questions on that? Okay. Well, that concludes our spinal cord class. Hello, I'm Patty McGlinchey. I'm going to teach you now the peripheral nervous system. Your terminal objective for this is to be able to understand the peripheral nervous system anatomically. Next class, we'll talk clinically. There's a bunch of learning steps. Your handout follows that in its organization. It will help you study. But as always, the whole class is testable. Yeah, you know that. Okay. All right, so some general information to begin with. This is a review for you, kind of a good morning wake up. Anatomically, the peripheral nervous system is made up of cranial nerves and spinal nerves. How many cranial nerves? Pairs. How many spinal nerves? Pairs. Which spinal nerve does not correspond to a vertebrae? C8. Very good. Okay, functionally, you can divide cranial nerves into those that are somatic, meaning they have voluntary control. Not that they always are voluntarily controlled, but they have that possibility, versus autonomic, which do not. They are involuntary always. Give me an example of an autonomic muscle or autonomically controlled muscle. Good, I like that one. The heart. Okay, so if you want to simplify matters greatly, the whole idea of the peripheral nervous system is to connect the central nervous system with the muscles and glands and receptors in the periphery. It's just a connector. That's all it is. It's wires, essentially. Some general anatomy. This is a review from yesterday. You have two roots coming off the spinal cord. They unite to make a spinal nerve. The two roots are ventral and dorsal, or you could call them anterior and posterior. I'm going to try to stick with the ventral and dorsal as I teach. Which one is sensory, the ventral or the dorsal? Great. So that means the ventral one is motor. Okay, then when they are united, it's called a spinal nerve. Does the spinal nerve have just sensory in it? No. Just motor?
No.
No. It's a combo. Okay, so spinal nerves are considered mixed nerves. Mixed meaning they have motor and sensory. How about your cranial nerves? For those of you that know cranial nerves, it's at the end of the class here. Some are mixed. Some, like, think about your optic nerve. You know that's one of your cranial nerves. Does that have any motor involved in it? No, it just takes in the visual input from the retina. So in the case of your cranial nerves, we're going to have some that are just sensory, some that are just motor, and then a bunch that are mixed. So they're a little bit different, spinal nerves and cranial nerves, because of that. Spinal nerves are mixed. We're going to talk about all the spinal nerves first and then get into the cranial nerves at the very end. So just generally, spinal nerves have connective tissue covering. Did the brain and spinal cord have connective tissue covering? Yeah, I didn't really present it that way as connective tissue covering, but what are meninges? They're connective tissue coverings. So the meninges, how many layers were there?
Three.
In the peripheral nervous system, you have three layers covering the nerves as well, but they are not meninges. You'll see the note on the handout that says they're continuous with the meninges. But structurally, they are different from the meninges, but they do continue with them as you get to the spinal cord. So the outermost covering, oh, I'm going the wrong way. The innermost covering is the endonorium. The middle covering is the perinorium. And the outermost is the epinorium. But it's not like meninges where they just lay on each other like layers. They actually have more organization to them. And let me show you this picture. It's the same one in your handout, although your handout looks like it's on a diet. It's a little skinnier. It shows the different coverings here. The innermost covering, endonorium, and endo, that prefix, you're going to hear that again when you hear other connective tissue coverings. I know definitely with the muscle you're going to learn it. It has the same prefixes, so get them in there. The endonorium covers an individual neuron. So looking at this slide here, here we have one neuron sticking out. Actually, there's probably about 7 or 8 of them sticking out. Each one of those neurons is covered by endonorium. Where do you think the myelin would lie? Outside the endonorium or inside the endonorium? Inside. Myelin has to lie right on the axon. Okay, so the myelin's in there. You're never going to see it diagrammed that way, but the myelin's in there. Endonorium surrounds it. You take a whole bunch of individual neurons with their endonorium covering and group them together and put some perinorium around them. That's what holds together bundles of neurons, bundles of individual nerve cells, the perinorium. It helps organize it. Okay, some of you might have very organized drawers, right? You have all your white socks together, all your black socks together, all your pink socks together. Yeah? Okay, that's what's happening here. Within a nerve, those that have similar functions will be bundled together. And the perinorium is one of the devices that does that, that bundles together according to function. Let's go out to the next layer, the epinorium. This is the outermost covering of a nerve. And I'm saying a nerve meaning not just one cell. I try to say nerve cell when I mean one cell, or I try to say neuron when I mean one cell. In this case, I'm talking about the peripheral nerve. All those nerve cells that are covered by endonorium, bundled together by perinorium according to their function, are then bundled together to make one nerve by the epinorium. So this picture pretty much, I mean, it says it all. Okay, what else is in there within the epinorium besides nerve tissue? Blood vessels. All right, there are some blood vessels, and there's even some fat in there. Some nerves have more fat than others depending on how much stretch they need to do. Okay, so, but the main thing is there's blood vessels in there. Okay, any questions on the epi, peri, endo? Then we'll move on. This is just another picture, and I think, do you have this one too? Yeah, you do. You have this picture as well in your handout. Shows it more on a simplified diagram. Okay, now we're going to go and look at what happens to that spinal nerve after it leaves the intervertebral foramen. The intervertebral foramen is that hole in the spine where the peripheral nerves come out to the sides. So looking at this model here, your intervertebral foramen are these holes here on the side of the spine. Not the one the spinal cord goes down, the ones to the side. Okay? As it comes out of there, your spinal nerve is going to divide. You can see it on this model. See, it branches into two. It Ys. And what you end up with are the dorsal and the ventral primary ramus. Sometimes people want to, you know, throw something when they start to hear this, because we just took two roots and put them together, right? Dorsal and ventral root made a spinal nerve. Now we're going to separate it again into the dorsal and ventral primary rami. Why? Why go through the process of putting them together? What do you think? I can't hear you. Well, it does kind of clean it up, so it exits the intervertebral foramen as one being, one nerve. But think about what the roots contain. Yeah, there's only one foramen, but you could squeeze out the two roots out that foramen. No, not protection, it's function. Think about what the roots contain. Dorsal root is what? Sensory. Ventral root is? Motor. We get to the spinal nerve, we have a mixed nerve. Now they're going to branch again. Do you think the dorsal primary ramus is just going to be sensory? No. No, it's still going to be mixed. So it takes some sensory and some motor and goes dorsally, which is towards the stomach or the back? Which way? Back. Dorsally is towards the back. The ventral primary ramus is going to take some motor and sensory and go towards the stomach. So what we're doing here is we're not splitting based on function. The split is based on location. The dorsal primary ramus is going to go dorsally to the back. The ventral primary ramus is going to go anteriorly towards the stomach. Or in the case of your extremities, it's going to go to the extremities. It's just a way to divide it for location. Now, you all know what a skunk is. Got a stripe down the back, right? Keep that in mind as you think about this dorsal and primary ramus. Oops, going too far. Where's my picture? It must be later on. You have the picture in your handout, and I know it's somewhere in my slideshow, but it must be a couple more. The dorsal primary ramus takes that motor and sensory innervation to a strip on the back, just like a skunk, just like their stripe. So it just innervates the muscles around the spine and the skin around the spine. That's it. The ventral primary ramus does everything else. So it innervates the lateral side of the trunk, the anterior portions of the trunk, and the arms and the legs, the extremities. Does a lot more, doesn't it? Yeah, the ventral primary ramus has a lot more to innervate than the dorsal. So we're going to talk a lot more about the ventral primary ramus because it's a little more complicated. What happens as it continues out is the ventral primary ramus braids with the other ventral primary ramus of the levels above and below it. So here on this simple model, we just have two spinal nerves coming out. Imagine from those two spinal nerves that both of them are dividing, and this one only one divides, but both divide. Now the two nerves from these spinal ventral primary ramus are going to come together, blend together, along with some of the others, and do a braiding, do a weaving. And at the other end of that weaving is going to come out peripheral nerves, which is what the title of the class is. This is how peripheral nerves are formed. And those peripheral nerves are going to have a little bit of one spinal nerve level and a little bit of another and maybe another or another. This whole thing, this weaving, this braiding together is termed a plexus. When have you heard that word before? Choroid plexus, solar plexus. Plexus is a generic term for weaving or braiding. Generic term. In this case, the plexuses are referring to the spinal nerves that come out mixing and braiding together. And then what they produce on the other end of that braid is a peripheral nerve. We're going to look at four plexuses, that's all you have, nerve plexuses, and name them and talk about which spinal nerves go into the braiding, which go into the plexus, and generally what peripheral nerves come out the other end. So that's where we're headed in this class. Oh, here's the picture I was looking for. I got to change my slideshow. Of spinal nerves. And I have another visual. I'll get it during the break to show you a plexus as well. I got the brain, but I left some of my visuals upstairs. So looking at this slide color codes what happens to a spinal nerve as it splits into the ventral primary ramus and the dorsal primary ramus. Which color is dorsal primary ramus? Pink. It's going towards dorsally, towards the back, posterior. Okay? And you can see it doesn't really innervate a whole lot. The yellow is your ventral primary ramus. Does it look like it's going into a plexus, though? Do you see braiding and weaving? I'm not really seeing it. That's because this is a picture, an example from the thoracic region. In the thoracic region, there is no braiding, no plexus. In that region, the ventral primary ramus tracks along the rib cage, along one rib, and innervates that region of one rib and the muscles above and below it. So where do the plexuses occur? Where you got arms and legs, okay, where things are a little bit more complicated. Alrighty, let's look at these plexuses, plexi, I guess we should say. The first one we're going to look at is the cervical. So we're going to start at the top and work our way down. The cervical plexus is made up of the spinal nerves from C1, C2, C3, and C4. So we are up high neck. They come together, they braid together, and the peripheral nerves that come out the other end innervate the muscles of the neck, some head, some superior shoulder, really not a whole lot. They don't do a whole lot, okay? The cervical plexus, they don't go to a lot, but what they go to is up in the neck region. So if you just keep that area, think cervical plexus, neck region. Clinically, there is an important nerve that comes out of that plexus, and that's the phrenic nerve. Basic medicine probably taught you about the phrenic nerve. That's the one that goes to which important muscle of the body? The diaphragm. Okay, so if you have a problem with your cervical plexus, it could interfere with your breathing, and that is not a good thing. Okay, next one, brachial plexus. We're working our way down now. So we left off at C4 with the cervical plexus. We're going to pick up at C5 with the brachial plexus. We go from C5 down to T1. So that's C5, C6, C7, C8, and T1. They all come together in a plexus, and what comes out the other end are the peripheral nerves that go to the upper extremity. Where do you think this plexus lies, the brachial plexus? Yeah, how much braiding is there before it becomes peripheral nerve? It actually lies right in this region here. Just near your axilla, just superior to your axilla. That's the region of the brachial plexus. This is where you do not want to be stabbed. All right? I have a picture in your handout of the brachial plexus. Here's a picture of it as well. This shows, let me get this off, and then I'll move back. This shows the brachial plexus, how you have the spinal nerves coming off. They weave, they braid together. And that section right there of the weaving and the braiding, this is your plexus, your brachial plexus. And it happens in a very organized way, all of these plexi, so that your braiding is the same as my braiding. It's not haphazard. Yes? Anterior. It's right in here in that mush in there. Okay, yes.
Is that where you get a sticker at a football game?
Yeah, that's the spot. Now, the picture I want to show you in my textbook, let me change my sources here and get this thing out again. I like this picture. It's one of these. Now I'm probably not going to be able to find it. I had it on the right page and it lost it. Where are you? Here it is. It shows the brachial plexus, but it shows it in a way. Remember, there are some things that I shouldn't do. You should see what our TV set looks like with all the wires behind it. God help us. Okay. Here you have the plexus at this end. I don't have a pointer, so I'm just going to use my finger. We got C6, spinal nerve. C7, spinal nerve. C8, spinal nerve. Look at that weaving, that braiding, the mixing that goes on. At the other end, the peripheral nerves that come out have a combination of maybe just C5, C6. Maybe they got C6, C7, T8. C8. Maybe they just have T8. There we go again. C8, T1. It depends on what happens within the mixing that goes on. Now, you could see how it can be dissected down where you could really know exactly what's going on in that plexus. So if you really wanted to, you can name every branch of this weaving and say which spinal nerves are in there, but we don't want to go there. Clinically, the most we're going to go to, already if I take this down, it's just to give you an idea of how complex it is. The most we're going to go clinically is to state the fact that when you have an injury of the brachial plexus, you can have some pretty stereotypical type disorders. And one of them is called Erb's palsy. Let me get to the slide for that. There's a diagram of the brachial plexus with all those different branches named. Erb's palsy is where you have the superior portion of the brachial plexus injured. And because of the nerve damage that causes and the muscles that don't get to, therefore, get innervation and contract, the patients end up with this, it's kind of a weird posturing, like this. They go into internal rotation at the shoulder and this sort of posturing here, which looks like a waiter trying to get a tip, right? The money. Erb's palsy. So depending on where someone gets an injury in the brachial plexus, there's a clinical positioning that you can have to determine what's going on clinically. And just to know, that's not where you want to get stabbed. And that's usually how the brachial plexus, if it's going to get injured, it's usually because of some traumatic injury like that, a stabbing or something going into that region being thrust in there. The next plexus, working our way down, and we'll break after we get done the plexus here, not this one, but the next one, is the lumbar plexus. Notice we stopped at T1 with the brachial plexus, and now we're hopping all the way down to L1. So what happens in the thoracic region? No plexus. It just follows the rib, okay? But in the lumbar region, the plexus starts up again. The lumbar plexus is L1 to L4. So we have four spinal nerve levels coming into it. Just like with the cervical plexus, we had four spinal nerve levels coming in. The lumbar is the same. And the peripheral nerves that come out the other end innervate the pelvis and kind of like the superior part of the hips. But they're in that pelvic region there. The femoral nerve does come off of this one, and that's more going down into the thigh. What big muscle does the femoral nerve innervate? Anyone know? Quadriceps femoris, okay? Good guess or good knowledge, whichever of the two. Big muscle, and it extends the knee. So people with femoral nerve injuries have a very dysfunctional problem. Without extending your knee, you have a lot of trouble walking, huh? Yeah, you got to get some bracing in there. Here's a picture of the lumbar plexus, but it's also a picture of the next one, the sacral plexus. And in fact, some textbooks will combine the two. and call it the lumbar sacral plexus. Because L4 is involved in both. It was part of the lumbar plexus, and as you'll see, it's part of the sacral plexus. The sacral plexus goes from L4 down to S4. It's a very large plexus, a lot of weaving going on there. It has the largest nerve of the body come out of it on the peripheral nerve end, and that's your sciatic nerve. There's also a common clinical problem of one of those peripheral nerves that comes out where one of the nerves gets impinged with the lower leg cast. I have it up there, the peroneal nerve. That's old school, folks. It's called the fibular nerve now. Anatomy hardly ever changes, but that did change. So the fibular nerve is right by the fibula. If you have a short walking cast, you know, below the knee cast, it can impinge upon that nerve and cause some problems. You'll learn about that in the weeks to come. So there's a picture of just the sacral plexus. The lumbar plexus is just superior to it. Any questions on the plexus? The plexi? All righty. What I have up here now talks about what I mentioned already about the thoracic nerves, how they just follow the rib and go around. Anyone here ever have a family member, or maybe even themselves, have shingles? Okay, we're going to talk more about that in the next class, but shingles usually follows a very weird presentation. It follows a rib. What it's really doing is following a thoracic peripheral nerve. And it's, well, we'll get into that with the next class, so I won't tell anymore. Yes?
We only have these four. What do they refer to as a solid plexus?
That's not involving the peripheral nerves somatically. That's in the autonomic nervous system, which we're not teaching. So, don't worry about it. All righty. I mentioned this as well. What comes out of the other end of the plexus? Peripheral nerves. What goes into a plexus? Spinal nerves. Spinal nerves are one nerve level, so a C1, a C2, a C3. Peripheral nerves, they have a combination of different spinal nerves. Are peripheral nerves mixed, motor and sensory? For the most part, okay? For the most part, they are. Are spinal nerves mixed, motor and sensory?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Okay. We're going to pick up now with dermatomes. So we're shifting gears, folks. Thank you. Dermatomes, myotomes, nerve fields, these are probably new words for you. We're going to talk today about the neuro-related terms of the bunch I just gave you, and that is dermatomes and nerve fields. And what's the difference between the two? To understand the difference between the two, you have to understand the difference between a spinal nerve and a peripheral nerve. Which one is right at the beginning of a plexus? Spinal nerve or peripheral nerve? Spinal nerve. And at the end? Okay. People make fun of me because of this. All right, so I'm putting myself out on a limb here. This is my homemade diagram of a plexus, the brachial plexus, with colored yarn, my favorite colors. All right, so at one end, by my face, you have spinal nerves. At the other end, peripheral nerves. Can you see how the peripheral nerves are a mix of colors corresponding to what they are at the spinal nerve level? So they go through and they mix and they come out a mixed nerve, not just motor and sensory, but now they're mixed by their spinal nerve level. All right. Now to understand these dermatomes and nerve fields, let me get a couple words up here first. We're talking about the sensory aspect of spinal nerves and peripheral nerves. Just the sensory part. There's other terms for the motor part. If we look at, what do we got here, C5, and just want to know where it gets its sensory information from at C5, we're looking to dermatomes. A dermatome is a mapping on the skin of the area of skin that corresponds to a spinal nerve. Mapping on the skin. So the sensory of that part of the skin will relate to one spinal nerve. With the exception of C1, don't worry about that too much. It's just all the other spinal nerves have them. These dermatomes resemble stripes on the body. You have a picture of it in your handout. In fact, you have three pictures of dermatomes. One's full body, one's upper extremity, one's lower extremity. And they do vary. So if you looked at different textbooks, you're going to find different stripings, different dermatomes of the body. There's a lot about you and me neurologically that is identical. The way the brain is laid out, the way the spinal cord is laid out, the way the tracts are laid out, identical. Yeah, there might be some mutants out there, but pretty much identical. When you come to dermatomes, we're all a little bit individual. So let me show you a picture of one on my slide. This is the most generic picture of a dermatome. You'll see this in a lot of textbooks. See how they look like stripes? The reason they're color-coded here is cervical, thoracic, lumbar, and sacral. Don't worry about the colors. Worry more, think more about the stripes themselves. So clinically, how can we use dermatomes? Well, you have a patient who has a herniated disc. A herniated disc, by definition, is what we have here. Actually, you got to get it close to see it, though. The intervertebral disc between the two vertebral bones bulges out. And the way it typically bulges is posterior, right where you have your spinal nerve exiting the intervertebral foramen. That tends to be the place where the bulging occurs. So it puts pressure on that spinal nerve. When the pressure gets on the spinal nerve starts to dysfunction. Two things happen because it's a spinal nerve. It's mixed, motor and sensory. So you'll see motor weakness as a result of the dysfunction, and you'll see sensory loss as a result of the dysfunction. The sensory loss of that one spinal nerve is going to correlate to the dermatome for that spinal nerve. So you could take out your chart. You got the MRI already. You know which spinal nerve is being impinged, which one is being dysfunctional. You take out your chart and you go to the patient and you check that strip on their arm to see if they have a loss of sensation there that corresponds to where their herniated disc is. If they do, you know then that that herniated disc is causing enough dysfunction to produce sensory loss. The next step would be to check the weakness. This one's called a dermatome. What do you think the weakness would be called? Something tome, right? Myotome. We'll talk about that in muscles. Dermatome is all we're going to talk about today as far as nerves. So stripes on the body. When you get to the different sections of the body, the different regions, you're going to have to know these dermatomes. In fact, you're going to have to know them real quick because the first region you get to is the spine. So you're going to have to learn the dermatomes at that point. For this class, I want you to understand what a dermatome is, but you do not need to label the diagrams or know specifically where L4 dermatome is. So the key things for me for now is that a dermatome is related to a spinal nerve and it resembles stripes on the body. And we're going to compare that to the next topic, which is a nerve field. The nerve field looks at the other end of the plexus. What's at the other end? Peripheral nerves. Great. And you know what I forgot to mention? It's in your handout. Peripheral nerves have the same three connective tissue covering that spinal nerves have. So what's the outermost covering of a spinal nerve? Epinorium. Norium nerve, epi, the outermost. So the outermost covering of your peripheral nerve is going to be epinorium as well. The inner covering? The innermost, yeah, we'll do the innermost covering, covering one neuron, that's your endonorion. And then the covering that takes a bundle of neurons, but not the entire nerve? Perinorium. Same connective tissue covering. Okay, so getting back to nerve fields now. Nerve fields talk about the sensory innervation of a peripheral nerve. Is it going to be the same exact thing as the spinal nerve? Is it going to look like stripes? No, no, it doesn't. If you look at this picture here, it's more patch-like. And that's how peripheral nerves come out, patch-like. This is something I'll bring out when I teach you about the hands. These things are so nasty because they've been around for 10 years. I made them back when I was here before, and I was so shocked to see that they're still here. I think I'll make some new ones because they're looking kind of... Okay, one of these is demonstrating dermatones and one nerve fields. Based on how they look, can you figure out which is which? Right hand is dermatones, left nerve fields. So now we have like a little bit of a problem here because they do overlap, obviously, but they don't have the same exact boundaries. So with nerve fields and dermatones, here we get to the clinical problem. My first clinical example was I told you they had a herniated disc. So now you're looking to see if there's loss of sensation. A similar clinical example for nerve fields is they have carpal tunnel syndrome, which means one of their peripheral nerves, the median nerve, is being entrapped or compressed in the carpal tunnel region. You may have heard of that, right? It's pretty common. So here you want to look and see if they have corresponding numbness and tingling or sensation loss for the median nerve, for that peripheral nerve. So I go to the median nerve's nerve field and I check it out looking for sensory loss on the tips of the fingers. If I see it, I know we have a lot of dysfunction in that median nerve. We better treat it. Okay? But what if you have someone that comes in and you don't know what they have? They don't know what they have. They just tell you, I can't feel anything on my middle finger. Well, now you got to look at the two charts and figure out, okay, middle finger, that's this one and this one. So we're either dealing with a I should put them in the same hands, right? A dermatone problem of C7, spinal nerve, or we're dealing with a radial nerve problem or a median nerve problem. So clinically, I got to figure this out. What would be the obvious question? Obvious to me. Obviously not obvious to you. I'm trying to figure out if it's nerve field or dermatone. They tell me their middle finger is numb. Look at the middle finger of the dermatone. Look at the middle finger of the nerve field. Okay, you guys are getting there. Now we want them to get more specific. Where exactly on your middle finger are you numb? If they say the entire thing, front and back, because they don't know anterior and posterior, dorsal and palmar, those words don't work to them. They say the entire finger's numb, front and back. Which one is it? Dermatone. So what should I be looking at? Peripheral nerve or spinal nerve? Spinal nerve. So now I'm going up to the C7 spinal nerve, and I'm going to be looking for a disc problem. Or something else, okay? If they tell me it's only on the pad of their finger that they're numb, I'm looking at a median nerve problem, because that's you'll learn this very soon. That's your median nerve distribution. So that's how clinically you use these nerve fields and dermatones. And sometimes it's real obvious like that. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes what they tell you is numb could be both a dermatone or a nerve field, and then you have to do other clinical things to figure it out. Okay? Does that work? Okay, it's not that hard, is it? Nerve fields, dermatones? For me, I want you to keep straight which is which. Which is spinal nerve? Which is peripheral nerve? Which is stripes? Which is patches? You got that? You're good. You don't have to memorize the charts yet. You can look forward to that. Here's some more example of nerve fields in the arms. And remember, every textbook's going to have different nerve fields. They don't have the exact boundaries on you and me. There's some variance. When we get to these parts of the bodies, we're going to teach you the prime spot that is typical in everybody for a nerve field, in everybody for a dermatone. So we'll tell you how to test those spots. Here's the lower extremity. And there's another one. This one's comparing the lower extremity looking dermatone to nerve field. Can you tell without even looking at the words which one's dermatone, which one's nerve field? Yeah. Look for that striation, that stripe. The zebra man. All right. Now, this is actually the easiest part of the class for me to teach. because it's pretty much saying memorize, memorize, memorize. Okay? This is one of these things you just gotta do. Gotta know the cranial nerves, their name and their number, because you don't know how they're going to be referred to out in the clinic. Somebody will say, I have a cranial nerve 2 problem patient. You got to know what cranial nerve number 2 is. Or they might actually give you the term, I got an optic nerve problem patient. So you need to know name and number, and then you need to know what these nerves do. What are their functions? Some are very easy. I like optic nerve. I know what that one does. I don't even have to really think about it. Some of them, glossopharyngeal, well, that kind of says it too. Facial, something about the face. But we got several things about the face. So let's go through them. If you are unfamiliar with Roman numerals, now it's time to get familiar. All right, what does a 5 look like? A V. How do you indicate a 4? The 1 goes before the V, which means you're minusing 1 from 5. If the 1 is after the V, 6. That means you're adding it to. Okay? If this is something new to you, Roman numerals, I'm sure there's someone in here that can help you out. The cranial nerves come off of the brain stem. So we're looking at the 3 parts of the brain stem. What's the most inferior? Brain stem? Medulla oblongata. All right, going up superiorly, what's the next one? The pons, the big belly, right? My brother, the pons. I have to get back at him somehow. You know, many years he's tormented me. The next one up superiorly? The midbrain. All right, so those 3 structures have cranial nerves coming off of them, 10 of them in total. The other 2 come off of what? Cerebrum. And I have to give you guys credit. I don't know who asked the question, but no one's ever asked me about those last 2 cranial nerves when I taught the brain class. People just accepted that I'm only going to talk about 10 cranial nerves, where they come off of, and who cares about the next 2. So good job. As a class, I'm impressed. Alrighty, now function-wise, you have some that are just sensory, some that are just motor. I could say afferent and efferent, right? And then some that are mixed. Function-wise also, you have some that are somatic, meaning going to voluntary muscles, and some that are autonomic, going to your involuntary muscles. At the very end of the listing, I have down the 4 cranial nerves with autonomic motor component. But let's go through them all. You don't have to know diagram-wise where they are. In fact, if you asked me right now, I'd have to fudge a little bit. Okay, it's one of those things that I'm glad there are diagrams to refer to if I ever need to. I know generally where they are, but when you show me on that, I'm like, oh, I think that's that one. Okay, so first one, cranial nerve number 1, olfactory, nose, sense of smell. This is the nerve that brings that sensory in. You can test all these cranial nerves. How would you test this one? Yeah, get something stinky and put it under their nose. What do you smell? Okay, very easy cranial nerve test. Optic nerve, cranial nerve number 2. This is your vision. It has nothing to do with motor control of the eye. Vision. So the receptors are your retina. Those cones and rods on the retina taking in the visual stimulus. They cross and it goes back to what part of the brain? The cerebrum? Occipital. Okay, that's where that vision sensory gets processed, the occipital lobe of the cerebrum. Then we have 3 that kind of work together, but unfortunately they're not in order. They're almost in order. Cranial nerve 3, cranial nerve 4, and cranial nerve 6. Those 3 cranial nerves are all involved with motor of the eye. They move that eyeball around so you can look in all your different places. You test these by having a patient do an H with their eyeballs, up, down, laterally, go across midline, shouldn't move the head, and then up, down, laterally on the other side. And that tests all these muscles, if you wanted to know that. The first of the 3 is cranial nerve number 3, ocular motor. And we're just staying very, very general here and saying eye movement. I'm not concerned that you know which eye movement they do, just that you know it's involved in eye movement. It also has another function. This is one of those that has an autonomic function, one of the 4. And it works in constricting the pupil which determines how much light comes in. And it also works to adjust the lens, to flatten it out, or when it relaxes, allow that lens to get more convex. So that adjusts your vision for near and far sight. So that's an autonomic component of the oculomotor nerve. The trochlear nerve, cranial nerve number 4, is involved in eye movement. And the abducens nerve, cranial nerve number 6, is involved in eye movement. So we skipped 5. So let's go back to 5, cranial nerve number 5. This is one of the biggies, especially, you know, thinking about our profession. We deal a lot with motor and getting motor function back. Trigeminal, cranial nerve number 5, is involved with the motor of mastication, otherwise known as chewing, getting that jaw working. Chewing, speech, okay, cranial nerve number 5. Now, as physical therapy technicians, you're not going to work a whole lot with patients that have chewing problems, but you could. Yeah, OT does a lot more, and speech therapy does a lot of that as well. But you could, especially if you're in one of those situations where you're deployed and you're the only therapist around, same basic principles of all muscle therapy and rehab. So that's your trigeminal nerve. Notice it also has a sensory component too. It does the sensory for the face. All right, don't forget that one. We test that as well. Now, as far as testing this cranial nerve, you make sure that they can clamp down and release, so close open, and then you test the face. And you test 3 different spots because there's 3 main branches of this nerve. Next one on the list, we're skipping 6 because we already did it, the abducens, eye movement. We're going to 7 now. I think of 5 and 7 together. I think of them as pals because cranial nerve number 7 is the motor for the face. Cranial nerve number 5 is sensory for the face. Cranial nerve number 7 is motor for the face. It's a confusing fact for a lot of people. So, you know, you might want to make sure you study that part extra hard because that's one place where people get confused. Which one is the muscle for the face? Facial nerve. Yeah, that's the one. Okay, cranial nerve 7. Besides doing the muscles for the face, and how you would test that is have people make funny faces. Let me see you frown. Let me see you smile. Okay, that would work, that one. And it also has a component which is autonomic for producing spit, salivation. Okay, so do you test that one? Let me see. Yes, spit. You can. Okay? You definitely can if that's part of your test. As well as tearing, producing tears, which is called lacrimation. Okay? So you want to tell them a sad story and make them cry? Not really. You're just looking to see if the eyes are dry or not. All righty. Next one down, cranial nerve number 8. Believe it or not, we do a lot with this in physical therapy as well. So 5, 7, and 8 are big physical therapy cranial nerve. Number 8, it's the vestibular ocular nerve. It is involved in equilibrium as well as hearing. 2 components there. It's the equilibrium component that physical therapy deals with a lot. When we have patients with balance problems, we need to look at the equilibrium. If nerve damage, is that the reason why? Or is it something inner ear? Or is it something coordination? The next one, let me get my slide moved here, is the glossopharyngeal. Just based on its name, you know it has to do with throat stuff. Glossopharyngeal, you got your pharynx in there, okay? So this one is your motor for swallowing. It also produces spit, so it's also one of those autonomic nerves for that reason. And sensory, this one does taste, and so does, I forgot to mention that, so does cranial nerve number 7. We have a couple for taste, actually three. So this is the second one for taste, the glossopharyngeal. Sensory, it also monitors your blood pressure at your common carotid, the carotid sinus there. Moving down, we got the biggie, cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve. This one is motor for all your guts, the stuff we don't teach in here. And on my handout, that's not listed. Is it on yours? Okay. It's, but it says motor too. On mine, it just has sensory for the viscera. Okay, good, good. I'm glad that's okay. So motor-wise, you have it going to all your viscera, all your guts, all the innards, the things we really don't study much in this course, as well as swallowing. It assists with that and lifting the palate within your mouth region there. Sensory, it gets all the input from your viscera. So this is a real important cranial nerve to keep you alive. All right, very, very important there. And it also is part of the taste triangle. So we have the facial nerve, the glossopharyngeal, and the vagus providing taste. Isn't that interesting? Three cranial nerves involved in taste. Sometimes you have to wonder about how it's all organized. Now, the last two cranial nerves are a lot like spinal nerves. They go to voluntarily controlled muscles, and they just have motor components. Spinal accessory is cranial nerve number 11. This one innervates the sternocleidomastoid and the trapezius muscles. So we're looking at some of your neck muscles that work your shoulders or do a lot of neck motion and shoulder shrugging. We'll put it that way. Shoulder shrugging and neck motion, you'll learn more about that when you get to that region of the body. And the last one, hypoglossal, is the cranial nerve for your tongue. So for these last two, the way you would test them is have them do the motions of their cranial nerve as well as sticking their tongue out at you. So that's always how you end your cranial nerve test. Stick your tongue out at me. Let me see you wiggle it around. We're actually not going to do cranial nerve testing. All right? That's something that we just, in physical therapy, it's not a major thing we do. Your therapist will learn how to do that, and they will do it with their head injury patients and any neuro patients. But as technicians, you just need to be familiar that there is cranial nerve testing, but we will not be going over it. All right, so just in summary, we got a couple of these nerves that are involved in autonomic nervous system, specifically the parasympathetic, and that's cranial nerve number 3, 5, 9, and 10. Any questions on this bunch? Now, every class comes up with a mnemonic, and usually it's something we cannot announce in class, about how to remember these cranial nerves. Figure out something that works for you. Ask your classmates if you don't have some sort of mnemonic to remember them, because typically there are some floating around out there from when you went through your other schoolings. Whatever works, folks, okay? And remember, I don't need to hear them. Okay, so any questions? In this class, I finally get a chance to do the summary. I'm not out of time. We looked at the spinal nerves, dermatones, nerve fields, cranial nerves. Looked at a lot, but it really wasn't as bad as the brain class, was it? No. Okay.